let's resume our business. The main order of the day, which is consideration of the 2006-2007 annual report of the National Department for Social Development. I'd like to welcome the Director General, Madam Sella. We haven't seen you in a while, so it's refreshing to see you still well. It's looking up. We hope you're well. And to be with us today. And obviously, the DJ will introduce his team. But just to say that we have just concluded a closed session with the Auditor General's office, and I can readily affirm to say that you have a reason to smile, because the overall impression that you got is that you're doing quite well. That should not make you too comfortable, because I think there's some tough questions that are coming your way, so brace yourself. Alright, on that note, colleagues, we shall proceed with the second order of the day. And I don't know how the department wants to deal with it. We forwarded correspondence to the department, in which we alerted them that this year we're doing things very differently. And that the Office of the Auditor General will be present at the tribunal. And that at the end of the presentation, when we ask questions, we would expect the Auditor General's report to confirm or respond whichever way appropriate to any issues that relate to the assumption that may arise in the process of this transaction. On that note, I would then hand over to the Director General. Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson, and the honorable members of the Portfolio Committee. I say the office that nothing would give me greater pleasure than the opportunity I have today to interact with the committee. The work of the department in the last financial year. We have prepared the presentation, which has been divided into four parts. I'll deal with the first part, which will cover the overview, essentially, and the performance information will be presented by Mr. Zane Dango, who is the Chief Operating Officer of the department, who sits immediately on my left. And the financial information will be presented by the Chief Finance Officer, Mr. Pakade, who needs no introduction to most of the members of the Portfolio Committee. I'm accompanied by a strong contingent of senior managers from the department. I would hesitate to venture to introduce them all, just in case some of them do not have the opportunity to make any comments. There's a greater risk that they might go back to Pretoria without having said a word to this meeting. So the very least they can do is to introduce themselves so that the Portfolio Committee can assist, hear their voices. Especially for Honourable Member Zumanda to at least recognize those voices, because I'm sure they are very important for his services.
The DG is caught up with the culture of this committee.
I wonder at what point it would be opportune for senior managers from this department to introduce themselves. I need your guidance there, whether you would like.
I think it's fine. Let everybody just introduce themselves directly. I think in the interest of time, maybe we must going to introduce them to the department of the members of the school.
Thank you very much, Jefferson. If that be the case, I'm going to ask my colleague, just across, Ms. Maloka, to start, and then we will come this way up. If you could come closer to the mic.
My name is Patricia Maloka. I'm currently the program manager for the Services of Teaching Institutions in the Office of the Director General. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and honorable members. My name is Julia Sokole, the Chief Information Officer in the Department of Social Development.
Sean,
Louis
does not know if you're here.
Good morning, Louis. So I think I'm from the PCP.
All right. We can talk to the mic. Thank you, members. I'm Lutan. I'm also the director of the Responsible for Cluster Coordination. Office of the Chief Operations Officer, monitoring and evaluation. Morning, another vendor.
Not at all, new flash.
Oh,
God.
Only vendor,
good morning, my name is Portia Ketana from Social Security Bank.
Good morning, my name is Jong. My name is Jong. This is Social Security Center.
Thank you for sharing my name. I'm so grateful for that. This is CFO in the department.
Ben Dango, Chief Operations Officer.
Okay.
I wouldn't make that mistake.
All right. Thank you very much, Chairperson. As I've already pointed out, our presentation is divided into four parts. I will deal with the first part, and Mr. Dango will deal with the program performance. And Mr. Fakali will deal with the budget and expenditure reports. And after that, Mr. Dango will then come at the tail end with Part B on the legislative framework. In dealing with Part A, I want to perhaps share with members of the committee the Department's strategic perspective, which is premised on two platforms. The first one being the services that deal with assisting society to deal with what they are currently experiencing as a result of poverty and social dislocation. And the second platform relates to strategies to deal with the sector that gave rise and sustain poverty, inequality, and social disorder. all this is based on a vision and mission appears on page 5, and our vision being that of a caring and an integrated system of social development services that facilitate human development and improve the quality of life. Our mission being to ensure the provision of comprehensive, integrated, sustainable and quality social development services against vulnerability and poverty, and create an enabling environment for sustainable development in partnership with those committed to building a caring society. The department has 8 specific priorities. The first one being creating an enabling environment for social and human capital investment, which essentially tries to demonstrate the fact that we're not simply a department that spends, but we are a department that invests in people. The second specific priority is promotion of social integration, enabling those who are on the margins of society not only to be integrated, but to be allowed to participate as full citizens in the socio-economic life of South Africa. The third is social protection initiatives to build the capacity of vulnerable groups. The fourth one relates to providing a comprehensive social security system, which system covers both the contributory and the non-contributory aspects of social security. And of course, Chairperson, as we present, you will see that there are other priorities that go beyond the Department of Social Development, in which we are making, towards which we are making a contribution, and that is the social cluster of government. So the fifth priority is providing leadership in social development to ensure the deepening of the social policy discourse and evidence-based decision-making. The fifth one is effective and efficient management of social development programs and activities in partnership with civil society and other social partners. The seventh is steering the national involvement in African and international frameworks and agreements with respect to socio-economic development. And finally, good governance, which I'm sure everybody would like to promote. An outline of our program, we in the last financial year we had 6 programs. Program number 1, which is generally referred to as administration, is one that provides for policy and strategic direction by the ministry, working together with top management for the overall management and support services to the department. Program 2 is one that focuses on comprehensive social protection. Which seeks to develop a comprehensive system of social security with norms and standards for service delivery, facilitating financial and economic planning for social security in line with developmental objectives, monitoring and evaluating social security services being delivered, and assessing the impact of policies implemented by the department. Program number 3 relates to social security transfers and administration. This relates largely to the money that we use to pay social funds. So in this program, we make funds available to administer and pay social assistance in terms of the Social Assistance Act of 2004. And this we implement through the South African Social Security Agency, which is established in terms of the South African Social Security Agency Act of 2004. And in this regard, we also commit ourselves to improving the integrity of the social grant administration. Program number 4 relates to welfare services, which I must say up front, in fact, forms the bulk of the work of the Department of Social Security, which is undertaken through a sizable amount of programs under selected sub-programs that fall under social welfare services. And these programs seek to ensure delivery and accessibility of integrated social welfare services to vulnerable groups. Program number 5 relates to development and research, the aim of it being to create an enabling environment for the delivery of integrated social development services through community development activities and population studies. And finally, program number 6 which relates to strategy, regulatory, and oversight management. And this program, which is perhaps the latest of our programs, in this program we provide specific guidance on social development, coordinate and evaluate, facilitate and develop the department-specific plan, align strategy with business to ensure efficient and optimal institutional performance, as well as overseeing all entities reporting to the Minister for Social Development. A range of these programs that we undertake feed into what has become known as the sector priorities in government, which is undertaken through the various clusters of government. But with specific reference to the work that we do, there are four sector priorities in which we make a direct contribution. The first being the expansion and consolidation of services to children, youth, older persons, women, and people with disabilities. The second being capacity building for civil society organizations, being organizations that we are responsible for registering in terms of the non-profit organization. The third one is the expanded public works program, in respect of which we do two things. The first one is that we coordinate the social sector plan on expanded public works. The second being that we in fact directly participate over and above coordinating the activities of the social sector in this regard, so that we directly participate in the two anchor programs of Homecoming to Care Share and Early Childhood Development through the programs that we have under the Integrated Development Program of the Department. Fifthly, human capital development in the area of social services, social services professionals. In this regard, we are talking about the training of social workers, social auxiliary workers, and a tapestry of other social service professionals whose work contributes to the overall objective of creating a caring society that upholds the well-being of members of society, especially the most vulnerable and marginalized in society. That concludes part A of our presentation. I'm now happy to hand over to Mr. Dango, who will take us through the program, part B of the presentation, focusing on program performance.
Thank you, Chair, E.G., honorable members. This is quite a lengthy part of the presentation, so I'll try and go through as efficiently as possible. If I speak too fast, please stop me. I'll start with Program 2, which is Comprehensive Social Protection. And as B.G. pointed out, the program objective there is to ensure the provision of effective comprehensive social protection measures and interventions, mainly focusing on income support. In terms of non-contributory social benefits, we achieved significant milestones with respect to developing policies and research for discussion and debate that was in due course addressed to many gaps in the social security system. Cabinet approved a policy and an implementation plan for the extension of social assistance to indigent refugees who are disabled. And the department developed a plan to cover contingencies of recognized refugees in respect of the old age pension, children in poor households and foster care. With respect to children's benefits, again, it's still non-contributory. We conducted a study on the need and potential implications of the extension of the child support grant to the age of 18. This report was submitted to Cabinet for consideration. Cabinet then proposed that the social sector cluster explore effective services to vulnerable children over the age of 14, as opposed to a social grant, as we saw in the said. The indication from Cabinet was look beyond income support only. In terms of disability and retirement benefits, we developed a draft assessment tool for care dependency grants. We facilitated the development of a draft report on social security benefits for people with chronic illnesses. And we finalized the piloting of the harmonized assessment tool, which started in 2005-2006. The planned implementation of this will commence in the next financial year, and this is dependent on the amendment of the Social Assistance Act and also training of SASA and Department of Health officials. The provision of social relief is expressed. Here we developed a policy implementation manual to support standardized interpretation and application of the provisions across the country. We disbursed an amount to the value of 22 million rand to provide at least 13,000 victims of disaster and an amount to the value of 3 million emergency relief funds to organizations that provide assistance to victims of disaster. In terms of moving to contributory social security benefits, social insurance, here we completed a review of retirement reform provisions. And there's further studies to support key recommendations with legislation for a state-provided fund. These are part of discussions that are ongoing, and we are part of an interdepartmental team that includes Treasury, and there's also an interministerial team that includes the Treasury there. Service delivery quality assurance. We implemented both the monitoring framework and institutional arrangements for the regular interface within the agency and the department to ensure continuity and improvement in service standards. We completed the report on perverse incentives, which was approved by Cabinet, and we completed a profile of 7,000 beneficiaries during this period. This report too was presented to Cabinet and approved. In terms of social security transfers and administration, this is a program on its own. Here we provision of social assistance benefits to vulnerable groups. And the program's key achievement includes a smooth transfer of functions to SASA, including assets and liabilities, to enable the agency to actually operate effectively. The net result of that would be that 12 million South Africans now access the social grant system, and these beneficiaries constitute more than 25% of the country's population, which is an indicator of the scale of poverty in the country. The total, and I'll read through this, actually, that even though SASA will do their own presentation together with us next week. But in total, the old age pension at the end of March 2007 stood at 2,193,000 beneficiaries. Disability, 1,427,000. Foster care, 394,194. Care dependency, 98,096. And the biggest growth was in the child support grant, which is 7,863,000 beneficiaries. You can see the growth from March 2005 to March 2007 was quite substantial. In respect to social welfare services, and as the DG has pointed out, social welfare services and community development together form the bulk of the core of the department's work since the establishment of SASA. In terms of child care and protection services, new child care legislation, Section 75, Children's Bill was signed by the President in June 2006, and it is now referred to as the Children's Act, number 38 of 2005. The Children's Amendment Bill, previously known as the Section 76 part of the Children's Bill, was introduced to Parliament in July 2006 and passed by the NCT. This bill has been passed by the National Assembly and referred to the NCT for concurrence. Early Child Development, ECD, is one of our four, one of the important areas identified for the Department over the next 2 years. Here we launched the Guidelines on Early Child Development Services in June 2006. We registered approximately 1,500 sites in 2006-2007, bringing the number of registered sites to over 11,000. There is on average an ECD site for every 455 children in the country, which gives us an indication that there's a lot more to be done, not enough. There's a paid per diem subsidy for approximately 314,912 children, and the total amount paid towards these subsidized sites for 2006 and 2007 was 350 million. In terms of child care and protection services, strategies to combat child abuse, neglect and exploitation, installed child protection register in all provinces, and the practice of upgrading the database in all provinces is ongoing. the child protection registers in 6 provinces are fully aligned with the new national web-based system. Alternative care, we developed a foster care strategy, we developed a comprehensive residential care database of registered child and youth centers. In terms of adoptions, we've registered 250 inter-country adoptions and 2,166 domestic adoptions. The training and placement of probation officers, 187 young people completed block 1 of training on the volunteer assistant probation officers program called VAPO. You can see Dino was more familiar with VAPO. We trained 93 probation officers from all provinces as assessors, and these are also mentors of voluntary assistant probation officers. General services to children in conflict with the law, approximately 1,986 children benefited from the home basic provision program, and 12,770 that were diverted from the criminal justice system. We developed a national social development action plan, which is linked to the intersectoral committee on child justice plan to address the shortage of services to children awaiting trial. We completed 3 secure care facilities, 1 in the Free State and 2 in the Northwest. Facilitated the development of provincial action plans to increase the capacity in 11 centers nationally. Out. In terms of social crime prevention, program and guidelines for children awaiting trial, we achieved a 50% reduction of children in prison and also South African police services holding facilities.
You're into program 4 now?
Yeah. It's for program 4.
Can I propose that we pause for 5 minutes and stress the outside?
Okay.
I wouldn't like to get a call. Sort of interrupt in the middle of the presentation. Just allow people to grab a cup of tea and come back in 5 minutes and then we'll continue.
In the meantime, we adopted the Western Cape Secure Care Detention and Probation Case Management. We will roll this out in other provinces as well. In relation to services to families, under the family policy, we developed a costing framework for the family policy. We finalized the training manual for parenting skills and the training manual on marriage preparation and marriage enrichment. We drafted the manual on family preservation and we're waiting approval on this. We developed a database of existing services and programs for families and within that consolidated input from 5 provinces, in Mpumalanga, Gauteng, Limpopo, Eastern Cape, and the Free State. With respect to victim empowerment, we launched an empowerment center in Butler, which is in Mpumalanga. We finalized a strategy involving men and boys in the prevention of violence against women and children. We finalized the framework for the implementation of the South African Victims Charter. We conducted an impact analysis on the resource directory of services for victims of crime. This report is available as well. With respect to services to older persons, we developed a community-based care and support services model for services to older persons. We finalized the plan of action on aging in line with the Madrid plan of action. We provided financial and administrative support to the South African Older Persons Forum. This was established in 2005 by the Minister of Social Development, the purpose of which was to promote and protect the rights of older persons, and also to serve as an advocacy body for older persons. Services to people with disabilities. We conducted a research on the social needs of people with disabilities. We developed policy guidelines of the following areas. The rehabilitation services for people with disabilities, residential facilities for people with disabilities, and also on management of protected workshops. With respect to substance abuse, in the last financial year, developed a goal for the prevention of and treatment of substance abuse, which I think is very important, the prevention element of it. Here we have briefing sessions on the goal of the Portfolio Committee on Social Development and consultations took place with other provinces. I think that's preparation for legislation that we'll usher in the next financial year. In terms of norms and standards, we developed minimum norms and standards for inpatient treatment centers and the best practice model for children and youth in treatment facilities. We also conducted rapid analysis on brain and substance abuse in the country. In terms of HIV and AIDS and services there, the purpose was to strengthen and roll out home community-based care and support. Here we funded 1,700 home community-based centers nationally, and also provided a wide and varying number of services. We developed mountain standards for HCBC services to ensure the quality of services and to provide a minimum package of services to be rendered. We piloted the draft norms and standards in 13 HCBC organizations, and 48% of these organizations comply with norms and standards. We conducted a situation analysis to inform the development of a capacity building and mentoring model for HCBC. So there's a link between the need to actually ensure that more of these organizations comply with norms and standards. We also trained 142 HCBC organizations on basically how to run organizations and organizational development. We commissioned a study to assess the existing monitoring and evaluation system for HCBC at national, provincial, district, and local level. We developed a model on psychosocial support, and this was done in consulting with the HWC test. Care and support for people suffering from HIV and AIDS. Essentially, we completed a process where we estimated orphans using vital registration data after the age of 30. We finalized the policy framework for orphans and other children made vulnerable at that age. We finalized guidelines and an action plan for the management of HIV for children and youth in residential care. We facilitated and monitored the establishment of 50 Love Life Office, and the commission decided to look at existing national and international databases for orphans and vulnerable children. A report on this is expected during the next financial year. Implementation of expanded public works program within home community-based care and support programs. 2,438 caregivers received accredited training, 12,213 received non-accredited training, 611 child care forums are fully functional, and plans are underway to conduct an audit to inform the role of the child care forums. We developed training materials to enhance the effective function of the forum. Program 5, which is development and research, in terms of the current, the past financial year, I think it's important to point out that this is constrained to community development. Under the section of community development, we've got a program called Sustainable Livelihoods, and here we launched the first phase of the pilot project on linking grants to livelihoods and cooperatives. This was in the Kikini in the Eastern Cape. This cooperative was established and registered with Cipro, so it registered as a company on the company's database. We produced a documentary and a case study of the first phase of this, and we're also introducing the concept in the program. And I think the importance of this is that, unlike wealthy services, which sometimes are statutory services, the project of community development, the services are a lot unclearer, and we need to develop what are the actual products and outputs of our community development ventures. So this is why the pilot was important. In terms of exit strategies for our poverty reduction projects, we finalized an MOU between national and provincial departments for social development to hand over the responsibility of the management of poverty relief projects to provinces, develop an action plan of spending funds on the IDP account, and we requested for deviation from the initial objective of the PRP framework that was submitted to national treasury. In terms of community development policy, and I think community development policy and community development services is again in line with the fact that we need to define exactly what we need to be doing here. We have a national consultative process to identify what are the key issues that are critical for the development of community development policy and an approach to community development that makes sense. In terms of improved conditions of services for community development practitioners, and I think the DG talks about social services professionals, which is really beginning to hit to instead of talking about social workers. We finalized job descriptions for 5 community development work levels. The CDP regrading practice was approved by MINMEC earlier this year. And the implementation date of the recommended salary levels 21st of April 2007. We work with the South African Qualifications Authority to standardize these qualifications and training. Provisions of integrated services in the integrated rural development programs and also the urban renewal. Thinking note, the Commission researched an analysis of livelihood profiles and assessment of the services of the department in all of these nodes. And then the importance of this was to determine exactly what the department is providing to households and families with a view of improving them. We had to assess of the, we needed to assess the impact of the services that we deliver and how to improve that. So this is quite a big quite a comprehensive research program. In terms of the youth development policies and strategies, we developed the youth development strategy which was approved by MINLA, and they completed the costing for the implementation of the national youth strategy. In terms of development and research, there are a number of national and international obligations. Chairman, I'm trying to run through these a little faster. We held a commemoration of South African Youth Day. We also the youth in Java, together with the Department of Health and Defense, provided support to provinces in commemoration of Youth Day. And all of these services are about profiling, these events are about profiling youth issues and youth services, with a view to getting more active involved in youth development. In terms of youth work services, we recruited 240 youth in line with the National Youth Service Implementation Guidelines. The South African Youth Work Association revised implementation of the youth work policy, and we held consultations with stakeholders to secure the buy-in and support to the practice of professionalizing youth service. In terms of the registration of NGOs, 6,507 were registered within the required time frame. This increased the total number of registered organizations on our database to 43,466, 4,722 annual reports were received, and 3,614 of these were then captured under the database. We deregistered 480 organizations because of non-compliance, and we also trained community development practitioners to assist and support organizations, particularly those that are not compliant. Removing people of the database is not automatic. You first have to assess what the reasons are for non-compliance, and it's about capacity of especially community-based organizations. In terms of the enhanced institutional capacity of the sector, we completed a training manual for community development practitioners and training of training tools. We also developed a CD to each province on this, and we conducted the same training of training tools in all the different provinces. Development team research. In the last financial year, the population and development unit was still included in the unit, so that's why we're reporting on it here. Now, essentially, population and development research activities serve to support policy development, monitoring, and evaluation in the department and government as a whole. The mandate here is across government, and the research reports that flow from research undertaken may include views on migration in Sub-Saharan Africa, and evaluation of joint population conferences, identification of information and research gaps on the impact of HIV and AIDS, and the research drives and needs. We also reviewed and updated and defined indicators to monitor the social impact of HIV in South Africa. So this unit is becoming de facto, together with our social policy unit, the research hub of the department. So transforming it beyond population and development and actually doing research that supports all of them. In terms of our international obligations, basically runs across all our areas of work, all four programs. But essentially, the social development portfolio has grown since 1994, and within that growth, there's a lot of bilateral and multilateral interaction that is required. And here, our focus is on the development of partnerships with countries experiencing similar problems. And some of the areas that we focused on were in the rebuilding of family and community relations. We looked at comparative and also supported initiatives around comprehensive social security. We looked at areas where the eradication of violence against women and children and other persons and also other elements of police department, and also in terms of our fighting as HIV AIDS and dealing with the social impact of HIV AIDS. Also, in line with our international obligations, the promotion of the African agenda and the fostering of international solidarity, one of the key objectives of the Department of DG outlined earlier, the following international fora the DG participated in, the 39th session of the UN Commission on Population Development, the African Union African Population Commission Bureau meeting, the meetings of the SADC, Dialogue on Population Development meetings, our engagement in the IPSA, the India Brazil South African Working Group, and there's numerous meetings on that. And these included poverty eradication strategies and also how to use indigenous knowledge and also focused on microfinance and cooperatives. So if I could run skip all of these because I think the details of the international obligations are in the presentation. We can answer questions on that. I think the important thing to mention though is under the African Population Commission, that South Africa was elected to chair the African Population Commission of the African Union for a 2-year term. And in the first year, the GSB led the review of the rules and procedures for the SEC.
Well, for the committee's interest, it might be useful to just touch on some of those areas of cooperation because we ourselves are exploring the possibility of the sector in our program. One or more members to actually partly look at our oversight role beyond our borders. Also to do study tours on certain areas of different development.
Okay, then I'll spend a bit more time on that. And I think the IPSA agreement and the engagement there is quite important. And we've had consultations with the IPSA International Poverty Center and Area of Cooperation. The IPSA Social Development Working Group was established in June 2006. The areas of cooperation with our counterparts include areas in poverty eradication strategies, indigenous knowledge, microfinance, and the cooperative systems they were identified. But important in the lessons for us here was not to go through some of the failed experiments that India and Brazil have been doing, some of these issues for longer than we have been doing, and particularly a caution against an overemphasis on the project approach to eradicating poverty. So some of those issues are very important just given the input from the chair. The first IPSA trilateral was also attended, was held in September 2006, and we have reports on all of this. The substance abuse was also an area that we engaged on the international arena. We held the first biannual substance abuse summit in February 2007, and delegates adopted resolutions that will be implemented in the 2007-2008 financial year. It was a very big summit and a very successful summit that for the first time brought together all the major players dealing with substance abuse. The DSD participated in the 50th session of the Commission on Narcotic Drugs in Vienna. And in terms of the Forum for Social Policy, the DSD hosted the post-international Forum for Social Policy conference on research and policy dialogue to action on population and development in Africa in March 2007. I just needed to emphasize that the first annual substance abuse was hosted by our. I think given that the scope of our international travels, we did in our annual report inaccurately report on the minister's travels. we felt the pain. We included travels that went beyond the scope of the financial year. It was referenced to the department's annual report. In fact, what the minister did was he undertook 12 official visits and spent less than 60 days outside the country during the financial year in question. And I think the importance of this, not necessarily the trips, but the importance of the engagement that we have with international agencies is that we're building a particular profile on the key issues that we're developing, and the net result of this is a significant increase in partnership. Some of it in kind, but some of it also in terms of donor support. So there's it's quite a huge benefit in terms of our engagement in both regional and international and social development. In terms of our strategic challenges, let me just put them all up. The first one is non-compliance with the non-profit organizations act, and I think this is where we also need to, after this, begin to engage more with the Auditor General Office around what the intention of the NPO Act is. But I think there's a clear capacity issue there, and what we're doing is appointing additional staff members to enhance our capacity to administer and manage the registered NPO. I think one of the key issues in the act, for example, is do our staff have the capacity to analyze financial statements of NGOs that they, that submit annual financial statements? And essentially, there's a question that we need to engage with. The intention of the NPO Act was essentially to facilitate fund spending accountability. So we'll take away the need to register to raise funds, but we put the onus on fund spending accountability. And the way that we do that is by making the, because these fund spending reports in the form of annual reports is essentially vetted either by auditors or by accounting officers. And what we need to be doing is making sure that our database is one that the public can access easily, and donors can access easily to get confidence that the kind of money they're putting into the sector is well spent. And doing the individual analysis is something that we need to look at, because it's 4,000 organizations this year, maybe 5,000 organizations next year, and we're hoping that the auditors and the financial, the accounting officers will do the book, do the audit, do the work, you know, according to the guidelines, which will reduce our duty in that area. But it's something we will look at as well in partnership with the agent office.
Can I just add that?
Yeah.
You see, we're going to need to have a serious engagement around the legislative review of the department. If you take that specific area, for example, back in 1997, the rationale behind deregulation of that, moving away from our fundraising to the NPO Act, was to remove the criminalization of non-registration and to create incentives in the next step to say that funders are likely to fund those organizations that are protected from the people and then flow. That the Gordon would be more keen to give incentives to those that are protected. But with the recent things coming up around FOCA and how much commission people can take to fundraising, I mean, it may sound like it's unrelated to social development, and maybe sports needs to come into the picture. Maybe we need a multifactorial diet. But the reality is that we are now sitting with a completely unregulated environment, which is completely voluntary, and the standards are non-compulsory. So we need to have that kind of engagement. That's just an example of various areas of legislative reform or legislative development where I think we're going to have further engagement.
I think just to add to that, the intention was to have self-regulation. And the also presence of active citizen and active donor community. So we're going to take those legislative discussion forward and have to take all those structures into account. I think another challenge there was the slow process of filling of posts. And the department reviewed the recruitment and selection policy with an intention of shortening the turnaround time. I think we've gotten our vacancy rate now below 20%. But we're still working on improving that significantly. In terms of financial administration of the social assistance function, it still causes many challenges due to the fact that there's dual responsibilities between SELTA and the department, which impacts on accountability, especially in relation to the big money, where the big money is actually the money that the grant money that comes out. And there's also a lack, in terms of the lack of effective management of information systems for social welfare and community development programs, These limit our capacity to monitor and evaluate the key service delivery institutions, which in the last discussion, we are actually non-profit organizations as our key service delivery institutions in that area. Because of the statutory bodies that come to the department and to the minister, we're going to talk about the relief board and also the CDA. In terms of the relief board, I think just a quick background, the disaster relief fund board was appointed in 2005. There were 15 board members that represented 9 provinces. And during the term of office of the board, no declaration of disaster was made in terms of the fundraising act of 1978. Most of the disaster events were dealt with at provincial and local levels. And since the establishment of the Disaster Management Act of 2002, Number 67, the Fundraising Act, the relevant section number 187 has become obsolete. So I couldn't take that one. Provinces affected by disaster have indicated that they are coping with disaster during the last financial year. In most cases, social relief of dispersed budgets from the provinces and SASA were utilized to assist affected communities. An amount of the value of 20 million was distributed to 12,000 victims of drought and gale force from the disaster relief fund board. In terms of the legislative framework, the board and the department consulted broadly on issues of legislative and institutional arrangements. It was noted that the present arrangements are fragmented and result in delays due to the consultation process by the board, and this is at a high cost to the department in terms of duplication of services. The Social Assistance Act makes provision for the disbursement of relief. Similarly, the Fundraising Act makes such provision. These complicate accountability between our BG and the chairperson of the board. And also the Fundraising Act, 1978, is not in line with some of the PFMA issues in government in relation to the issues of disaster relief. The department, together with SASA, are consulting to harmonize the relief provision, and that's why we just have to use theme from our relief section in case there's any questions there. And in this harmonizing process, we are reviewing policy on social relief to establish one social relief goal that would cover all relief provisions. And it's important really to make there. In terms of disaster relief in the last financial year, the vote of funds was 10,000 and grant for the amount was 10,000. Chair, I'm not going to go through all the areas. It's really, we find a specific area in terms of disaster relief. In terms of the CDA, it is the Central Drug Authority. It's a statutory body and it's established in terms of the Prevention and Treatment of Drug Dependency, Act Number 20 of 1992. And members of the CDA are appointed by the Minister and consist of representatives from different government departments and entities. And also we have experts from the private sector, experts in the field of substance abuse, so it's a multi-sectoral institution. Achievement of the CDA, six meetings were held to finalize the rules of the CDA and the code of conduct. There's a really important point is the National Drug Master Plan was approved by cabinet in October 2006. Several national and provincial workshops were held to train representatives on how to develop goal-oriented mini drug master plan. Like I indicated earlier, we organized and worked together with the CDA to serve the annual summit on substance abuse. We conducted research on substance abuse trends. We held a workshop to provide strategic direction to the CDA. Provincial substance abuse forums were set up and they are monitoring the process of implementation of the drug master plan. And local drug action committees were also set up to do the same. In terms of the utilization of finances, and the funds were spent by the directors, substance abuse, and the CDA. In terms of the actual expenditure within the CDA, a lot of it is in terms of the administration around the CDA. The biggest sort of expenditure item was on the National Drug Master Plan and also the annual report. So but this is an area in terms of our fight against substance abuse that we looking to scale up significantly over the next few years. Because the challenges in relation to the CDA, there is a need to establish CDA office at provincial level. So dedicated CDA staff coordinate provincial drug forum and also the local drug action committee. So it's about ensuring that the CDA reaches communities with drug abuse and substance abuse problem. And due to inadequacy of funds, some of these activities are basically not attended to. This includes the national database and the national hearing on. So there's two faculty issues around the CDA that we need to be addressing in the second place. Yeah. The CDA and the government essentially have a budget of its own that shares with the substance abuse and function within the department, so that the funding there comes from the department. I won't go through the figures there. Which leads me to part C, which is the financial report.
Alright. I think we're going to take care of the other items of the presentation and then we have a break before the end. Can I carry on?
Yes.
Thanks, honorable members, CG, colleagues. I guess the chairperson has indicated earlier on that we have not spent much, that there was some prior engagement with the AG, but I still need to tread carefully on what I have to say. I've been warned. It's a tight place. We warned that there might be tough questions coming out.
Yes.
So I must prepare myself quite well. Chair, honourable members, I think what perhaps I should say upfront is that the report of the Auditor General, as you've seen it, does highlight a number of issues, but mainly these issues focus on the issues relating to social assistance. Mr. Dango did indicate in his presentation that there was a challenge around the issue of dual accountability as well. Probably one of the most difficult and challenging years in my entire career history in social development. And my colleagues take this light and laugh at me when I equate it to, maybe I draw an analogy of a guillotine. Those who know a guillotine, you are lying there with your head inside the guillotine hole. Right up above you is a shining blade, and you are asked to move out. You are free to go, but your hands are tied behind your back, and your legs are tied, and you can't move. So it's a situation of that nature, but I think we cannot do nothing about it. We have a situation where we have been given or assigned accountability by Parliament of funds to the tune of 57 billion rand. And we do not have responsibility for administering those funds. And we also do not have full authority on how those funds should be administered. Yes, I should be very clear on this. The money is voted to social development, but you have a situation where the person who has to pay the money and disperse it to beneficiaries is somebody else. In this year under review, it was both provincial departments as well as SAFA regional offices, as well as then you have a situation where the DG and I haven't got full authority in deciding, you know, what kind of policies and procedures must be in place in terms of managing that money. We don't have full authority in terms of hiring, firing staff. So it's a situation that is very, very unique.
we understand it's a transitional challenge, that it's a problem that we are facing with now, while we are starting to get Papa up and running in full swing. But Chairperson, I think if you look at the Auditor General's report itself, it highlights the things that it could have been worse, but what we believe in terms of if we did not have cooperation with both provinces and FAFA, the CEO of FAFA, some of the things could have even gone worse. We had a tripartite agreement which was supported by political principles, where FAFA and provinces were clarified what roles they will play during 2006-07, because now the money was no longer voted in the provincial legislature. The money is a national fund, but we have to rely on provinces in terms of helping us to administer the fund, because FAFA is still a new institution, it didn't have the necessary capacity. So that tripartite arrangement assisted us to at least be able to manage this transition in such a manner that we can be proud to say at least no significant material mishaps or problems have been experienced. Having said that, Chair, I would like to come back to the slides.
Well, I can just quickly comment in that regard and say that we are looking forward to meeting FAFA next week. The last time we interacted with them, it was all lovey-dovey and we were all shaking and hugging. I am not sure how the interaction is going to look like next week. But we'll certainly ask some questions to the department around that class of tax administration, but we'll get to it towards the end. So obviously, we are mindful of what they're talking about.
Thank you, Chairperson. If you look at the actual spending of the department, that will be on slide 16, we have been allocated a total amount of 2.3 billion rand. Now, that includes both the operational budget for the department, as well as the transfers to the public entities, as well as other transfers to institutions that we're funding. Example would be the disaster relief force, which report has just been given, in Love Life, and such kind of organizations. Now, we managed to spend overall 98.9% of the budget, which is indeed a good thing if you look at the challenges that I've just outlined. The bulk of the savings or understanding was largely on the social assistance transfer, which is approximately 700 million, and we're talking billions, yes. Which was not spent, and again, that there are reasons for that, because when you do projections for such a huge program, where you, even if you have had your best estimates in terms of your population trend, your demographic trend, etc., you are unlikely to budget to zero or to spend to the last cent. There are people who come and go in the system. You need to take care of those factors when you prepare a budget. But also, there is an ongoing drive, the anti-fraud campaign, where we identify in the system those people who should not be benefiting from the grant. Civil servants, for instance, that have been identified. We terminate those people once we pick up them. So those are the kind of reasons why you probably see such kind of variances when it comes to spending against the budgeted amount. If you look at the slide 53, that shows you the split between the transfer to households, which is basically your social grants, as well as your other transfers. The transfers to households constitute 92.5% of the budget. And then your other transfers constitute 7.09. That 4.3 billion under other transfers includes the money that we give to SASA for setting itself up, that is the establishment money, as well as the administration cost for social grants, that is the handling fee that we pay to service contractors, and also money that we give to SASA for their normal day-to-day operations. Then the overall amount remaining for the department is 255.8 million, which constitutes about 0.04%. Out of that 255 million, then we managed to spend 94.8%, which leaves us with a saving of about 14 million rand. I will come back to some of the reasons for the underspending. Then, in terms of the...
Is it an understanding or is it a saying?
Well, it depends from the angle with which you look at it. We want to be cautious when we're in Parliament, not to use the word like savings, in case we find ourselves in trouble. But we... Yes, it can be both, Chairperson. It can be both. But to explain, saving is more like a deliberate, conscious action that you take in order to avoid spending. For instance, I indicated earlier on that if you do not want to give money to fraudsters in social grants, you identify them and stop those grants, that's a saving. But if you do not spend money while there are children out there who are qualifying and eligible, but you don't reach them, and then that's understanding. So it's always difficult to unpack it, because if you want me to unpack it, I will go for the more favorable one and say it's a saving in its entirety, but I know it might not be.
And it could be that the budget tax for it, there are children out there, but they haven't come forward to
yes.
collect their benefits. I'm not sure what they call that.
Yeah.
But anyway, these are substantial.
Then the next slide then speaks to just the split of the budget according to the economic classification, how much is spent on salaries, which is your compensation of employees, which is about 42%, and then we spend on goods and services, which is the actual program that we run in the department, which is about 55%, and then also capital expenditure, which is just a minimal amount, because we do not have social development. Our work is more labor intensive. We don't spend money on roads or subways, highways, and so on. Then the next slide, the social grant administration functions are taken over by SASA. I think this is what I've already explained earlier on in the issue of the tripartite agreement. I don't think I should necessarily repeat that. When it comes to that amount, as I indicated on understanding, on administration of 1.1 million, Chairperson, I think Mr. Zainteng did indicate the challenges that we had about the vacancy rate. We managed to reduce it to 20%, but I think we still have a lot to do. HRM has appointed a recruitment agency also to assist them with the filling up the process of filling vacancies, like they do the advertising and selection and screening process, so that when they give the work to the department, it's easy. Already they give you options of who they think is best for the position. They also assist with the issues of job evaluation, etc. So we are hoping that this will be expedited. Unfortunately, sometimes at the budgeting time, you have the urge, because of the workload that you have, to fill as many posts as possible. We might have slightly underestimated our capacity. I mean, overestimated our capacity for filling posts. Hence, some savings, most of which is due to that. The second one on the emergency relief. The emergency relief fund has been running now for, I think, the last 3 years, if I'm not mistaken, three or four. This fund is purely to look at emergencies though there's a disaster relief board, the disaster relief board can only release funds once the disaster has been declared as a national disaster. Now, in cases where there is a need for for assistance, we come in and give immediate support, like blankets, tents, and so on. So again, that money you can spend and finish it, or even need more, or you may underspend, depending on whether you have been confronted with that situation. And unfortunately, for us, the policy guideline for the Treasury said we must also first establish whether provincial departments have the required funding and capacity to intervene before we come in. So it does, in a way, create problems, because you go to Western Cape when there is a disaster, where there is fire, and if the province says, no, we have got adequate capacity to assist, then you don't come in. So overall, we have a saving of 2.7 million. I can say to this committee now that already I have received claims this year, and this money has already been committed for disasters, I mean the new allocation for 2007-08. The program 3, I think I've spoken to it, the issue relating to social assistance grants, why there was a failure there. Then program 4 on welfare services is just a small amount of 186,000. I don't think we should be worried much about it. Then program 5 is another one, in program 6. Program 5 relates to a number of posts that were created. I must say upfront that during the restructuring of the department, we focus on the key delivery programs, I think welfare services as well as integrated development, which forms now this program called Development and Research as well as Social Welfare Services. Most of the newly created posts there are the big numbers where we're trying to fast track the filling. So you'll find that there will probably be more savings in those programs. And program 6, again, is an entirely new program in the department. Yeah, I think it started created last year. It's going to be the program that drives monitoring and evaluation, issues like oversight on entities, strategic planning, as well as the creation of suspected notions, the creation of key institutions that are strategic to the department, things like the appeals board or appeals tribunal for social assistance, things like So those are the institutions we're talking about. But yes, I must say, if you look at where we were last year and now, so many positions, especially critical senior positions, have been filled. Unfortunately, some of the senior managers, chief directors and directors who have joined the department are not here. But we definitely, the situation has changed this year. In fact, in my mid-year projections, it's the only program that's already projecting overspending. This is a totally different scenario from what we had last year. When coming to the real business, the report of the Auditor General, we had, an unqualified audit opinion, albeit having also some emphasis of NECA. If you look at the issues raised by the Auditor General, 20 of the issues raised in the management letter, now we picked up these issues in the management letter, not in the audit report, because the audit report will deal only with significant matters that require attention of Parliament and public. But those that are housekeeping issues for management to address, if they don't address, then they also become significant, then this one that we're referring to. And these control issues are issues that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, where, for instance, maybe the control is where somebody does not follow the procedure. Maybe it's a document to be signed, somebody does not sign it. So these are the things that need addressed through empowerment of staff in terms of sustaining or in some instances disciplinary action being taken against them. There were also financial related matters, which could be matters relating to misallocations of funds. Maybe you use an incorrect objective, so it will have an effect of distorting the information in the financial statement. Then there are issues of compliance. As I said, there are certain regulatory frameworks like your procurement framework and policy. There are things that you should do in terms of buying goods and services. So those are the things that there were nine of those. And then some of them relate to value for money, which basically relates to how best we have achieved the objective with the same kind of funds that we have. So the department has already developed an action plan. In fact, about 2 weeks back, we have tabled it in front of before the audit committee. And already 20% of some of the identified weaknesses have already been addressed, and we are ongoing addressing the issue. In terms of the emphasis of matters, the arrangement that I referred to earlier on between us and FAFA and the regional, and the provinces, one of the things in terms of the shifting of the function that should have happened was that the all assets and liabilities that used to be owned by provinces should be transferred to the national department and or SAFA, depending on what would have been agreed upfront. We identified this need, Chairperson, and we approached Treasury, I think, quite in good time to try and find some guidance, because there were serious issues, fiscal issues that needed to be resolved, especially issues relating to the old balances that used to be the responsibility of provinces. There has been cumulative amounts of, for instance, unauthorized expenditure due to overrunning the budget by provinces. Now the question was, would you take those liabilities and transfer to the new accounting officer at SAFA, or the accounting officer within provinces remain responsible for that? Now Treasury had a strong view that the accountable officers must take responsibility, and we expected them then to guide us on various nitty-gritty issues. We covered all the assets, both physical assets, tangible and non-tangible assets, but we did not get a response from Treasury until late in the year. I think we only got end of March when we closed the financial year. That became now a problem because we couldn't unpack this and reconcile these balances in time for reporting purposes. We had an engagement with the Auditor General, and the Auditor General's view was that it would be impossible to consolidate these balances in our books, because if we do that, we're sure we're going to get a disclaimer, because it's huge, significant amount of money that needs investigation by provinces, with us driving that and monitoring the process. So we have begun with that process now, and we are hoping that by end of this financial year, all the balances would have been cleared, because there's a clear directive now from Treasury that tells us exactly how those balances should be treated. The only difficult part, which we have discussed also with Treasury, and they've given us an exemption on this, is that the debtors, social assistance debtors, are a problem. It's quite a number of them, and they are in total a little bit significant, because it's just on average, we're talking about plus minus 150 million. Now these debtors are those that we can pick up. There are debtors that have not been recorded by provinces at all in any of the books, which we also have to unpack and reconcile back to the financial statement. So we have to do this, because now this, in terms of the flow of funds, the money sits with the department, and we have to reconcile this data and report on them in our own financial statement by end of this year. It's not really going to be possible. We have had discussions with Treasury, and they've given us that a period of about 2 years, which means by end of March 2009, this must be finalized. So what we're expecting by end of this financial year is to have all other balances cleared up, except for debtors. Debtors, there will be significant progress. We've got an action plan, which is in phases in terms of how we do this. But because of the nature of the problem, it's not going to be quick. There's going to be follow-up on people's receipts, people who have paid back, and provinces, some of them, or most of them, have not kept records of who has been owing and how much has been paid, how much is the balance. So it's quite a bit of a challenge when it comes to that. Chairperson, besides that, the other matters that we also raised relate to mainly what I referred to earlier as a guillotine example. The control that has been lacking, the beginning of the process starts with the application by a beneficiary, and then it gets processed, it gets approved, and then it gets paid. All what the Department of Social Development does, get money from the revenue fund, which has been voted by Parliament, and then we transfer it to SASSA to pay. Now, all these witnesses that are there, if for instance, the software controls are not working properly, or the people are not exercising care and controls around the actual processing of payments, etc., this thing is done outside the department, but the department remains accountable. Now, what we have to do now, we are having a joint team. We're working with SASSA. We've gone through their business processes, just to do the mapping of their business processes, to understand whether they have, in fact, addressed some of the significant findings by the Auditor General. So the work teams are already at SASSA as we speak. But this relates to documentation of transactions. They're also looking at the availability of files. If, for instance, files are not available, then the auditors will say it's scope limitations because they cannot verify the transactions that have taken place. We have also spoken to SASSA about it. They have indicated to us, I must say, I haven't personally verified this, that most of the files that were not found have been found because it was due to the movement. By the time they were moving files from provinces to the regional offices of SASSA, some of the things were still just in boxes, so they could not be accessed by the auditors when they were on site. So we are still going to verify all those things as we interact with SASSA officials to try and address all these challenges.
Does that relate to the 40 million questionable expense around SASSA?
Yes. It relates exactly to those issues of payments that have not been verified because there was no supporting documentation.
There are the only category, or is it a whole myriad of other things?
There are other things. One of the things that we have raised, again, is the auditors are here, can verify this. There was an issue around the policies and procedures that were not uniform. For instance, we find that in certain regions, they follow certain procedures that are different than what was adopted maybe as a national policy. One of the challenges was some of the tasks were handed over to the regional offices mid-year. It was done by provinces. Provinces were adopting their own internal procedures in the province. Then SASSA regional office took over and they would adopt their own procedures. However, there was a need for the head office of SASSA to give guidance and manage that process in a way that there is uniformity across when they take over this function. So in a way, we can't say we are not to blame. We can share the blame to say we should have done better in terms of getting those policies and procedures rolled out throughout the region. But those are the other concerns that we pick up, which is, again, some of the perhaps the treating problems of a new organization. Then the issue of reconciliation, as well, the Auditor General, because this expenditure again sits in our books, these reconciliations are taking place at provincial level or regional office. But now again, the issue was every month you need to know how much you are given and how much you actually pay to beneficiaries, how much is unclaimed benefits, the money that you're not paying, etc. And also even interest that was earned in certain accounts for service providers or maybe in the bank accounts of provinces. All that reconciliation should every month be done. Mm-hmm. So the problem that we picked up is that those reconciliations in certain provinces or most provinces were not properly done, and there were questions there about how much, I mean, how accurate is the money that is recorded. We have, since beginning of the year, visited provinces, we physically set down the provinces and assisted with those reconciliations. Have we not done that, I think the Auditor General would have been less happy. We showed them a schedule of all the reconciliations, province by province, that we did. And they were, to an extent, comfortable that we have dealt with the material differences. For instance, there was Limpopo, KZN, and Northwest, most of the provinces where we had challenges. So we addressed those challenges, we traced back those transactions, what they were. In some instances, there were monies that were used for administration, though they were supposed to be for social grants. We reconciled that, and then we reflected the correct amount of actual social assistance expenditure. I think, honourable members, the last issue is just to say what is the way forward as a department. As I indicated, we do have a consulting group that's assisting us, which we actually appointed as well in the year, just about the close of the financial year. Because of our lack of capacity, we had about three individuals to cover nine provinces and do reconciliation. What we do mostly, we don't necessarily use our people. We deploy people who go to the provinces and identify key individuals who must perform certain tasks, and we have an action plan and dates by which they should report back. Unfortunately, as I said, sometimes we do get resistance or lack of cooperation, but largely there's been good cooperation. But where we have those small challenges, there are some slight delays. And again, it's a question of try to cooperative governance strategies to persuade people, because DG&I can't discipline or take any action over those people. We have to rely on their cooperation. So that's what we have been doing. But now we have a team which has been given, and this task was, the plan itself was presented to the HSD, and the CEO of SASA was also present at the HSD. There was consensus that we should continue with the work. We will keep reporting back to HSD on progress, on how far we are with the reconciliations and everything, in order to prepare ourselves for the end of the financial year. We will be presenting a progress report to HSD again on the 22nd and 23rd of this month when they convene, if we are given a chance to see. Just to update you on the health of social services. Yes, but SASA CEO also is a member of that forum. Those are the major issues. Oh, there's one other issue, I think, which was raised by the Auditor General, which relates to the IT audit. And my CIO is here, and I know he has been working hard on some of these issues. These were the issue relating to some controls around the access, as well as database maintenance, etc. Yes, it's procedural issues, for instance, when people are supposed to have no access anymore, maybe they are still there. But I think those things have been, as far as I know now, have been addressed by the CIO and his team. And I think, because
let's get the last part very quickly.
Thank you, sir.
And then we will reserve the balance of the time for an interactive process, so that members are able to focus on what they consider should be where the emphasis of the matter should be. All right. Didi, the last bit was saying that.
That's the legislative program for 2007-2008. I'll go through it as quick as possible. The Children's Act 2005 and the Old Persons Act 2006, both acts are not yet fully operational. Certain sections of the Children's Act were operational in early 2007, both require regulation.
How accurate is that? Is the older person operational at all, or is it completely inoperative? Because we need to be sure that the statements are circulated accurately.
Roland, you want to comment on that?
As far as I'm aware, the older person, since we passed it, it's a complete pass.
and we keep on hearing we'll see some regulations. So is this statement accurate that both acts are partially oppression? Is Lamet offering an answer? Just hold the DDG. It looks like
I can confirm that the regulations on the Older Persons Act has been published in the Government Gazette on the 2nd of November for comment. So if the idea is that it will be operationalized later in the financial year.
And that still doesn't answer my question. In fact, it actually confirms that the statement is inaccurate. So you've vindicated my suspicion. All right. Did you want to add anything to that?
I just want to indicate that whilst we are waiting for the regulations to finalize that process, but there is work that is being done. It's not like we have closed up and waiting for the regulations to be done. Hence, it says that it's not fully operational.
Okay, we also say that regulations are both acts and the process is being finalized. I think in terms of the children's vote, the department has...
I think it becomes an act to deal with politics. All right.
The department has during August 2006 interviewed the children's vote in Parliament. The bill is currently being debated by the Select Committee for Social Services. Also, indications are that the bill may be finalized by the end of November 2007. I hope you're correct there. prevention of and treatment for substance abuse bill. The department envisages to introduce new legislation during March 2008 for the finalization by the end of the year. And the bill was submitted to cabinet. During July. In terms of regulations, the following regulations will be finalized, basically in the earlier point. So the Social Assistance Act of 2004, the Children's Act of 2005, the Older Persons Act of 2006, the Social Services Professions Act of 1978, and the NPO Act of 1997. The department also envisages to introduce new legislation in 2008. That is the Social Services Professions Legislation, the Nonprofit Organizations Amendment Bill, the National Development Agency Bill would be reviewed, the Social Assistance Amendment Bill, Social Relief Funds Bill, the Children Amendment Bill, and the Retirement Reform Legislation we put in here, and we're also saying that at this stage we're saying that work needs to be done on retirement reform legislation. We're not saying that ultimately the department may be the custodian of that legislation, but as part of an interministerial and interdepartmental initiative, we need to put this on the legislative framework. So there's discussion, both of us have been previously around this. Then also the prevention of and treatment for substance abuse law would be on the legislative agenda next year. Thanks, Jeff.
Alright, thank you. You see, this is one of the concerns that we have, is that towards the end of the term of Parliament, we suddenly have this big rush, legislative rush. We had a similar rush in 2003, when we had about four pieces of legislation to pass in that one year, at least it was introduced then. But, right, so that is the presentation. I'm going to give the opportunity for members to put their answers to supplement their questions. I have Hoshi first hand. I'm going to restrict people to three questions initially because of concerns of time. I'll just go this way. Hoshi, Ms. Weaver, Ms. Sample, and McCarthy, and then I'll come back this way comment on quality. Let's just take the first four, and then we'll come with another four. All right? So it's Hoshi, it's Weber, it's Santo, I didn't see it. Alright, Congress Mahutra, and then, that's what we see, Mamorobi, and then finally, Congress Mkongi. We'll take that first five, and then we'll take another one. Alright?
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is related to Program 3. I just want to find out from the department what mechanism that they put in place to show adherence to PFMA after transferring the amount to SASA. Second question, Chairperson. I have got a concern, Chairperson, with regard to filling of funded vacant posts. If you check adjustment estimate of 2006, the department is talking about savings as a result of slow filling of vacant posts. And if you again you check the revised estimate of 2007, the same reason given, Chairperson. If the department is serious about filling vacant posts, Chairperson, you remember when we do oversight, wherever we go and met with frontline staff, shortage of staff is the order of the day. But if there is a recurring slow filling of posts, Chairperson, I've got a very serious concern whether the government is serious about addressing a better life for all for these people, because it impacts badly on the people on the ground, Chairperson. Thank you.
That is nice and succinct. The next one, Ms. Weber.
Thanks, Chair. I would like to just find out, I know it was explained to me once before about community development practitioners compared to community development workers. I would just like to find out if community development workers are also being trained by the department. Also, regarding the vacant posts, it seems to be quite critical. Are these being registered at the Home Affairs as a scarce skill? And I see that there is allocation put for research. Now, in this research, could you tell me if perhaps it would be falling under this mandate regarding the amount of foreign people who are accessing grants? We've had a bigger problem in Home Affairs where late registrations of birth are now becoming a great problem because we're considering foreign people access to ID documents and thereby accessing grants, which I don't think we are such a social state that we can really afford to be getting these grants. Could the department just fill me in on that? Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Campbell?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much to the presenters. I program 5, the youth work services. Youth work services, recruiters, journalists, and youth in So when you go to the actual annual report, in the sections underneath services, over and over again, it says that things couldn't have been implemented due to lack of capacity, limited resources, lack of funds, etc. Can you tell us what you do with those problems are? In that section, I think that they are in many other sections as well, because obviously about capacity issues. And, you know, we say that because of those capacity issues, it doesn't really affect it, as far as status is concerned. It hasn't affected the allocation of the grants, the spending of the money. But, you know, I am concerned about the impact on delivery and the fact that the money is not reaching the people it's intended to. And I just want to know whether any research has been done into that, and in fact, what the result was, because I'm not really allowed to make the statement, but I'm not sure, because it is necessarily not impacting on the delivery. And then finally, Jed, do you want to take a question on South, or do you want to wait for next week?
I'll take questions relating to SASA to the extent that they relate to the responsibility of the department.
Okay, thank you. And I think that's the point, Chair, that whatever is happening in SASA, and again, the department has been sent to us, and both of the and the CFO have said that in fact the back stops the thing where as far as SASA is concerned. And I think that the, certainly we are concerned that although this is the first year of SASA's operation, and there are new departments, and so obviously there are going to be glitches. But actually, you know, that they mustn't start off in the way they intend to carry on. And then the football can climb very sharply. And I want to know what the DG is actually doing as far as oversight in that particular issue concerned. And what is he doing about monitoring the issues there? Does he have a strong investigative arm to make sure that they are doing what they're supposed to be doing? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. The next person was Comrade Morodi. Yes.
Thank you, Chair President. My question relates to monitoring work. I want to know when the province has allocated some funds to a certain organization, and if the province does not account for the honorable minister that the time the department will not account properly. Because I know of an organization which was funded by the time in 1999 of an amount of 50,000 rand. It is 2007 and that organization has done nothing. I don't know whether that 50,000 is put in a bank or not. I don't want to know whether it would be given change or it's forgotten that X amount of money was given to the community for become any generation. And secondly, Chairperson, it is quoted, the Minister was quoted this week as saying that donor funding, which has to be funded to treasure first, is creeping today. What would be the recommendation with regard to the donor funding? And again, can we get the breakdown of the human as persons with disabilities who are appointed to a level, concentration on level from 9 to 16? Lastly, Chair, I want to find out the 2,488 caregivers who are trained. How are they being identified? And which areas are covered? And the 240 youth recruits, are they enough for the country? Or is there still going to be some more recruits just to cover the entire area?
All right.
Thank you for that. The last one for this round, Comrade Nkong.
Thank you very much, President. Now, the department is reported upon the National Youth Strategy. I want to know whether this youth strategy is integrated to the National Youth Development Framework among the Youth Commission and Service to Cabinet. So, what is the relationship? Because there is that national movement that is taking place in terms of the Youth Development Framework. So, what are the relationships? The relationship. Two, the department spoke about the retirement reform legislation and also reported that it deals with other departments of government to deal with it. But we know that there is this process of the comprehensive social security system. What is the relationship between this legislation that we are trying to propose and that process that is beginning to take place within government to deal with this comprehensive social security system? The third one is around the question of the numerous litigations that the department is involved with. I mean, what has been the total, I mean, cost of that? And who budgeted for this cost? Is it within SALSA or is it within the department? So what is happening with this process of litigation? Thank you very much.
No. I think that some of these questions, in part, relate to the issue, for example, of to what extent that the department has an influence on what happens in the province, apart from a structured partnership such as the one that we have formed around the transfer of grants from provinces to national to SASA. There is a whole area of service delivery where the services actually happen at provincial level, where national might not have any direct control on the actual enforcement of norms and standards that are nationally agreed, and the funding allocation is nationally determined. But when it comes to the actual implementation, both of the spending of the funds and the implementation of the program, you then have this lack of focus, and national might not have that kind of direct controlling influence. So I think that's one of the issues we really keen to see, whether the heads of departments have any real hold on it, or is it something that will remain elusive for as long as the fiscal federalism element in our democracy continues. All right, over to you, please respond to your question.
Well, thanks very much for your question. I will try and deal with the easier questions, and then defer others, the more difficult ones, to my other colleagues here.
That's what we don't expect from the DG.
Well, in fact, I will focus on the more generic those are specific. I will allow senior managers here to deal with them. The first generic question, I think, is the one that relates to vacancies. In that regard, this perhaps will be a perennial problem until such time that the procedure in the public service change in particular ways. I say this because there are specific requirements that must be met in the advertising of posts, procedures that must be met with regard to the number of days, at what level the post must be advertised, and so on. There are posts that cannot be advertised only internally, which means that you have to advertise them in national media. And usually what happens is a post is advertised, say, for 21 days. 21 working days in a month is essentially a full month. After that, you then have a selection panel that starts off by preparing a shortlist out of an average of about 200 applications per post. The shortlisting process takes no less than 2 weeks. If you're fortunate, in fact, it will take 2 weeks. Otherwise, it could take more. Because these people who sit in the selection panel also have other responsibilities to do, in addition to going through the CVs, trying to identify candidates that are fit to be interviewed. By the time the shortlist is prepared and in fact approved through the channels that are set, you're already in your second month. And you then are able to interview your candidate, if you're fortunate, early in the third month. If you find suitable candidates, and all your candidates are available on the days
on which they are invited to the interview. By the end of the fourth month, you have your candidate to recommend for appointment. Hopefully it takes about a week or two before the appointment is effected. You're already now in your fourth month. Now, this successful candidate could be in another department of government or elsewhere in the corporate sector. This person is required to give at least 1 month notice before they can start with it. 5 months down the line, only are you able to fill a position. Now, these procedures were introduced certainly to ensure probity in the selection and recruitment processes, to minimize the risk of nepotism and so on. But certainly there is the unintended consequence that it takes long than to fill a single post. Now, in an instance where you have a sizable number of posts to fill, you will find that, in fact, in some of those posts, in the selection panels for those posts, some of the people who sit in the panels of other posts also sit in those panels. And there is a ripple effect on the delays, on how quickly you can move with it. Now, what we've thought to do is, and this is what Mr. Picard has pointed out earlier on, that what we're trying to do is to engage the services of a recruitment agency, which can then obviate certain of these steps, which may be occasioned by the fact that managers are nonetheless, in the normal course of events, overstretched with work. That once applications are received, they do an initial screening for you. That takes away plus minus 2 to 3 weeks of work. And then once the selection panel has that, they'll still have to do some verification that not a single good candidate has in fact been omitted from the shortlist. And after they satisfy themselves with that, then they run with the interview process. So on average, it will take you no less than 5 months for a new staff member to start. Even if they are in the public service, to have them transfer from one department to the next is not as easy as that. So that is the biggest challenge that we face. But the attempts that we have made now, to a very large extent, have reduced the work time here. On average, I would say, between 3 and 4 months, we're able to fill the post. That's the best you can get in the circumstances, I'm afraid. We would have preferred a much faster process. In fact, if we had the idea, we would want to fill a post within a month, but it's not doable. That's the main difficulty we have there. You want to add something? Okay.
Perhaps the Honourable Chair, there's one little thing I wanted to add to the TG. If you're looking at the posts that are in demand, like where maybe you call it scarce resources, one of the biggest challenges, again, especially if that candidate is within government, you are likely going to, at the end of your process, get a counter offer from the other department. Or this particular person will just get another job because there's quite high mobility within government, either in the province. Then you start the process afresh. In fact, you can't say, let me go back and use what I have. The rules demand that you must re-advertise, and then it's an entire cycle again, which is very, very frustrating.
Thanks very much, Mr. Kaya. I think that was a very useful addition to my plea. The other, not so generic question perhaps, but one that I think needs to be dealt with at this level, is one regarding foreigners accessing social development. Social development through SASA moves from the premise that if somebody has an ID, and that ID can be authenticated through electronic means by tapping into the database, cross-referencing with the database of Home Affairs. If the Home Affairs database says, yes, this person exists, and their name is so and so, and then we have no reason not to accept that application. Which means that even if, in the opinion of the official, the person they see in front of them, and I don't know how they would even do that, think that it's not South Africa, they have no way of receiving that application. Because this person has presented an identity document which has been, in a sense, the validity of which has been confirmed by Home Affairs. Then on the face of it, we have to process that application. In fact, our own efficiencies have now come to haunt us. In that SAFA is now able, you will recall that in the past, it would take us up to about 3 months for an applicant for a social grant to get to know whether or not the application is successful. SAFA today is able to do it in a matter of minutes. By the time they leave the mobile unit, they know whether or not the application is approved. And indeed, because of that, as long as they've been able to electronically verify that this document is authentic, there's just no way of doing it. What complicates, of course, is the fact that we're not in control of the systems in Home Affairs. And until such time that those systems can themselves be protected against the risk of wrong people being into that system, there's very little social development is able to do to withhold the benefits from these people. The other generic, I thought there was another generic question here.
But before you proceed, I think the point is clearly legally correct. But I'm just wondering whether Home Affairs itself has not come to social development to say, we actually acknowledge that our systems are not necessarily completely foolproof. And we know that the social grant program creates an incentive for people to actually want to actually defraud the Home Affairs system, because once you've gone past that hurdle, then you can go ahead and exploit this benefit. I'm wondering whether Home Affairs cannot in some way be encouraged to in terms of their own systems of looking out for possible exploitation of this kind, to extend their own mandate to social development, to say, let's find ways of cooperating to be able to pick up some of this very smart fraudsters who obviously have mastered the constitution and all the laws of the country and know their rights very well, even though they don't have those rights because they're not entitled in the country, to just find a much more pragmatic approach to this very elusive and very difficult challenge. I accept the explanation, but I'm just saying, isn't Home Affairs also coming forward and making this acknowledgement and saying, let's find a way, you know, of being creative and innovative around this problem?
No, indeed, Jefferson. I'm certain that attempts can be made. We have in the past made attempts in our interaction with Home Affairs. But our interaction, in a sense, was to encourage them to issue birth certificates and IDs to people who are eligible. I'm not sure how they will receive encouragement to the contrary. perhaps they should be more careful. It seems to me that it's not simply a case of system simply being too loose. This is the work of people who know how to manipulate the system, who sell IDs, who sell certificates and so on. I'm certain that Home Affairs is seized with the issue, which is why, in fact, they are proposing moving away from the green ID into ID cards. One hopes that that doesn't open another floodgate. Because once you are in transition, you are more vulnerable. So one hopes that, in fact, they're able to manage the risk very well in that process. What we've also done, you would be aware that there was an attempt at some point by advocacy groups to pressure social development into accepting alternative forms of identification, like hospital cards or clinic cards, or possibly even school reports as a form of identity for a child on whose behalf the child support grant has been sought. We have not accepted that route, not because we are insensitive to the fact that there may be children who are legitimately South African and legitimately in need, but who unfortunately because of a lack of ID or birth certificate do not access the grant. What we've done in that instance though is that we've extended social relief of distress to try and minimize the possibility of hardship, especially what is in the law called undue hardship, being visited on these children. And in that window period of 3 months, during which they can still receive social relief, we then interact with Home Affairs on to assist these children to get the necessary documentation. We will not stop interacting with Home Affairs to see how best they can enable us to make sure that people who are legitimately entitled to these benefits get them. But at the same time also help us make sure that they keep out people who are not entitled to these benefits. Certainly that interaction will continue to happen. It wouldn't be a problem that only social development faces, because the housing department has a similar problem. That people on your RDP housing waiting list, they all present ID. And when you check them with Home Affairs, you find that they're on the database, this thing looks legitimate, look authentic. So it's not only social development, which means that we need perhaps a government-wide response to this challenge, with Home Affairs being as a center.
I've just reported and referred a duplicate case where my constituent is unable to operate his bank account and to receive his salary because when he applied for the replacement of his lost ID, he discovered that it's a duplicate and they're saying it will take about 6 months for them to unravel that. But in the meantime, they can't even issue a temporary ID, so he becomes a sanction. So I'm just emphasizing the point that the convert also, as you put it, should also be taken account. So that people should not be unduly inconvenienced as well. Oh, all right. You want to make a follow-up still on this one, because he still is answering the other question. All right. Very quick one.
Yeah. My follow-up case is it's not Home Affairs alone. It's the DG right here. Home Affairs also got people who get CC from Department of Health around the checklist. Yeah, if the Department of Social Development are going to discuss about this thing, they must also include
all the clinic cards and things which are the basis on which they are proven and granted in the first place. It may not be authentic itself. All right.
Of course, I raised the silly question during the debate on the Children's Amendment Bill, and the Minister responded by saying that he was talking to the Minister of Justice in order to make it possible for magistrates to deal with the matter of documenting children without birth certificates. So, but there is obviously contact, and it's obviously is an issue that's been addressed.
All right, I think all those matters are in hand. Okay, DG, you can go check with the other person. Is it a follow-up on some of the questions? All right. Can you use the mic again?
I don't know how to say it before. Get results checked. You are going to receive it. I don't know if that's heard, but look, it takes about 5 months to 6 months to employ one check. But all these have words, high standards, that are not really conducive to us in dealing with this social problem. But let's put this in the Home Affairs in this context. The problem is still is we must remember very well why we had a Home Affairs of that kind of nature. It has been there to flush out and put down particularly black people and open gates for all the foreign Italians and Portuguese and all the foreign people that came into this country. You see? You see, you keep on running away from the reality of the situation.
Yeah.
Unless you address the reality, and you still find those guys out who have been there, eager to promote apartheid up to its last letter. So, I understand the problem of social development. There's very little that they can do with this problem. We need to look into Home Affairs in its entirety. Because as long as that Home Affairs is still meant by those people who are there, who are still there. They are still there. There's no way you can move it. They'll propagate that confusion that I experienced today. Thank you very much. This was just a comment.
Yeah. No. I think that at an appropriate point, we'll look at joint sort of sessions with other portfolio committees on issues of common interest. Child justice, for example, with justice. And this one, there's a number of policy areas where Home Affairs and social development have a common interest. We'll find a way as we go along. How we cooperate. Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. You are, by the way, protected by Powers and Privileges Act as a member of parliament when you put emphasis on that. All right, you keep proceeding.
Yeah, Captain, my last bite, as I said, and then to refer to other colleagues. I'll deal with one relating to social security because the DGT Social Security is not here, as I've already done with the one relating to social assistance. There was a question raised by Honourable Member Gonki on the relationship between the retirement reform legislation and comprehensive social security. Comprehensive social security is the overall platform in that it says all aspects of social security must be brought together. But in introducing them, it would be impossible to introduce all of them at once. There are those that you will prioritize. And in this instance, the priority has been given to retirement as a component of comprehensive social security, which looks at contributory schemes, where people are able to contribute towards their pension, so that when they reach retirement age, they're able to tap into their own savings, if you like. So retirement reform is in fact part of the comprehensive social security framework. And then perhaps at this point, let me pause and defer to my other colleagues. I wonder whether
we're going to ask them to be very brief in their response. It's already 1 o'clock, and I made a promise to the other colleagues that I'll give them an opportunity on a second round. Can we agree maybe to go into 15 minutes of lunchtime? Is the House commencing at 3 today?
Yeah.
Right. All right. Please proceed, the other managers.
Chair, I will just be brief in answering Honourable Member Hoshi's question around the monitoring mechanisms after we transfer funds in terms of the PFMA. I think we are wary of the challenges that are facing a new institution, and also we, on an ongoing basis, we monitor SAFA's capacity. Hence, there was a joint decision between ourselves and Treasury that there must be an interim arrangement, especially in the year under review. It's only this year that Papa has taken full charge of the funding. And again, it was due to the fact that they have adequate capacity to in fact do the disbursement. We also were cautious by centralizing the entire financial management of this fund. But in terms of fundamentals, FASA is a Schedule 3A public entity. Every year, before we approve their budget, they have to give the minister the strategic plan that outlines what they have to do over the next 3 years. And then once we have evaluated that and tabled in second parliament, then we begin to be able to transfer the money. Again, the TFNA also says we must ensure that they have the necessary controls in place, that is Section 381 says. So we do assess that and check whether they do in fact have the necessary pillars, key pillars. We don't leave it at that. TFNA says we must report, they must report quarterly. But what we have done, we have an arrangement with them that every month we have monitoring reports, financial reports that we receive, in terms of the numbers, projections, in terms of the actual expenditure. Because that is things that in any case we have to capture in our own ENA monitoring system. So there is that. But there's over and above ongoing cooperation. We provide what we call interface meetings where the DG and the DDG sit with top executive of SAFA and press out issues that are of common interest, whether it's about investments that have to be done or any other matters that affect the two organizations. So in short, I would say we are still improving in terms of how we monitor and oversee SAFA, but we have set the basic fundamentals to make sure that we don't just send the money and we don't follow up what's happening to that money. In fact, we are assisting even with reconciliation. I'm currently sending people there to assist them to sit them through the reconciliation. And we might be formally seconding some of them. I've got some requests already because of the handover process, because they are going to do the issues of projections themselves now and all that, and prepare payment schedules every week and every month. Yeah, thanks very much.
Any other senior manager? Right.
Thank you, Honourable Sir. I'll first deal with the question on what the difference between community development practitioners and community development workers. The community development workers are it's a cadre of people that we can sort of call communitarizing in a way, that are supposed to be assisting communities in ensuring that they know about the services that are provided by government-wide, and also ensure that in cases where there are communities that are unable to access those services, they identify those areas and refer them to relevant departments. They sort of work like, soldiers on the ground, that ensuring that communities are aware of the services and they do access services. And they're working closely, the community development workers, with the Department of Provincial and Local Government, but also with the Department of Public Services Administration. But there is a close link then in terms of the work that they do and the community development practitioners who are experts then, whose role is in terms of providing professional work in ensuring that they go into communities, profile the communities or households in terms of understanding what are the challenges within those households or communities, analyze that information to the extent that we are able to develop programs that are going to address those gaps that are there. So you can see that the community development practitioners, they are much more professional in terms of that, and their work is in relation to identifying the challenges within households and ensuring that programs, relevant programs, are developed. My colleague indicated earlier on, Mr. Dengo, when he was presenting, that this is one of the areas in terms of community development that we really need to strengthen and ensure that we understand the outputs that are expected out of community development. And I hope it's clear in terms of that. But obviously, they need to be working together, because if a community development worker on the ground identifies some gaps, that information needs to be referred to the community development practitioner that helps to ensure that the detailed analysis is done and relevant programs are developed in cases where there are no programs. The second question, then the question was, who is supposed to train community development workers? Currently, the training is done by DPLC and the Department of Public Service and Administration in terms of community development workers. The next question was around Program 5, around the youth service, the fact that we indicated that we have recruited 240. And the question was, given the lack of capacity that is there, is this number really enough? I need to indicate that, first of all, the National Youth Service is a government-wide program where each department is expected to identify areas within each department where we can attract young people where they can provide services. And within social development, we have identified those areas. And our initial process was to identify areas around assistant probation officers that would assist with probation services. But going forward, we have identified other areas that will begin to attract youth within the context of national youth services so that we can even strengthen the work that we do as social development. So this was the initial process. The question around, I don't know whether the DG responded to the question on breakdown of women and people with disabilities, 11. The annual report itself, I think if you look at around page 252 and so forth, it really gives a wide variety of the breakdown in terms of women, disability, in terms of those that have resigned, the appointments, and I would encourage honorable members to go to the annual report to look at that breakdown, because it will give you a picture in terms of that, even beyond just an appointment of women and people with disabilities and other areas too. The question on 2,478 caregivers trained and the fact that how did we identify this? Within the expanded public works program, as social development, we have identified two areas. The home community-based care is one area, and the early childhood development is another area. So in terms of the achievements that you reported here, those caregivers are the caregivers that are operating within home community-based care. But also, I need to indicate that, as you know, that the objective of expanded public works program is also to ensure that we attract those that are unemployed, we train them, so that they can access employment opportunities, develop skills, but also assist in accelerating service delivery. So those caregivers were identified within home community-based care programs where they are, but some of them were identified as volunteers that are unemployed so that we can bring them in terms of ensuring that they have relevant skills and opportunities in terms of employment, The question on 240 youth there was a question around around national youth strategy in terms of what extent is this related to the broader national youth strategy by the commission. Again, the broader national youth strategy by the youth commission, it's a departmental or government-wide strategy. And each department, and in terms of implementation, is expected to be implemented by all departments. And in terms of each department, therefore, is expected to unpack that broader national strategy so that it identifies the areas within a social development we have out of that broader strategy, identify those areas that relate to us as social development, and develop a strategy that is going to be implemented by social development sector. So it's part of that bigger strategy, but focusing specifically on social development mandate. I think those are the questions that I don't think of yet. Thank you.
I wanted to understand, because the example that CFO has given of deploying people to fix the structure and help them out, develop systems and actually
you know, conform in terms of the control issue. It's a good example. I'm not sure with the kind of support that national department is supposed to give to provinces, because we have a problem of understanding there and the problem of processes delivery. And we can come with the role of national in terms of monthly standards and all of that things. But at the end of the day, that must translate into provinces then implementing that legislation, implementing those promises, so that the actual services reach the people. And I'm not sure whether I got a sense, you know, as to how, even in the context of separation of power, a national is able to exert its influence at provincial level. Because that's the area of work which, going forward, I think we're going to put more emphasis on. We're happy that systems are in place at national, but what's happening where the actual service delivery is supposed to happen. Right. Any further comments on this before I give the second, the last round?
Just on that last question, I think it's important that we address it. And I think in terms of the intergovernmental relations framework, obviously there are limitations in what we can do as national. But what we have done is gotten the heads of social development to agree to HSD becoming, at least in the areas where we have put in sectoral bids, for example, on ECD, that in future these HSD become accounting forums, where if we put targets in place, we can report back as to progress in relation to that. So that is a huge step forward in actually fostering better alignment in terms of delivery and implementation. And HSD will then on a quarterly basis also report to MINNEC. So MINNEC also becomes an accounting forum. Unlike SASA, we don't have the latitude to deploy teams to strengthen certain capacities, and that's part of
we but we'll find a creative way to interact directly with provinces. But anyway, all right. Of course, it's complicated because there's the NCOP and there's the provincial legislature. But I think this committee has been bold in interpreting its mandate very generously. Hence, we visit provinces when we do oversight. But anyway, all right, the next, the last round of questions. I've got Honorable Zulande, I've got Magumede, I've got Comrade Makasi, Comrade Mystery, all right, who else? Hoshi, I'll only come back to you if we still have time. So those are the four that we're going to take, all right? And then we'll see after that. Okay?
Thanks, Chip. Chip, there's a myth that blind people can curse and bless. The department has improved, so we've been talking to them about provision of braille and accessible material and that type of thing. I think we need to note that first, In Parliament, in general, I think they are the department that is improving day by day in trying to provide accessible material. So maybe I will bless them. Hopefully they will come back next year with the annual report that is really good and start having performed in terms of the auditor's comments.
Oh, that's
great. Thank you. The steering of the national involvement, you know, into Africa and various international instruments. We raised last year an issue around, you see, on the formation of the African Union Chair, there was an omission in relation to disability. There is gender, there's the commissioner responsible for gender, there's a commissioner responsible for social and all those commissions that are there. And then we highlighted the issue around the African Rare Institute, which is an institute that was formed by the African Union before and inherited by the African Union around disability. And social and labor ministers. So in Africa, they combine various ministries and call them, you know. So the Minister of Social Development obviously here, and he's supposed to be working or sitting in the council with other ministers all of South Africa taking partnership with it. I would introduce that question last year. Obviously, Chair, then maybe there might be a comment in terms of if it was ever given any attention or any processing. The two chairs, the department presented the disability policy or disability strategy last year, and we would also want to hear anything. What I've heard today in the presentation was an issue around racial capacities for disabled people. Perhaps I will qualify for the house there or something. I don't know what it is, Chair. But the an issue around that thing on the racial capacity of disabled people. I don't know what it talks to our strategy. Is it part of social security? Is it, what it is? Is it elderly disabled people? Is it any disabled person? How does it directly compare to social security, Chair? That's a good question. And then I've been very doubtful for years in understanding the the impact and the implementation of the victims empowerment program and that support. I had also in the presentation today that they talked about opening another center in Malanga or somewhere. To say I'm not sure that it relates to the renewed strategic positioning of the department in terms of coordinating and leading, facilitating the policy direction and coordinating the management thereof in terms of setting standards and that type of thing. But my issue is that I haven't really looked at managed to get anything that indicates the impact of this program. So I'm not too sure, Chair, maybe they might share something, some comments, in terms of its effectiveness, and how does it help in promoting this integration of these people that are victims, or even helping, what do we do, basically? I'm really not sure what happens there. And then, Chair, in relation to we also had Treasury and the CFO, I think last year, we raised an issue about this question about spending, understanding or savings. You know, the Treasury said to us that sometimes there's now a new trend that the provinces are not even keen to take more funds because of the capacity issues. But if they know very well they will not be able to implement, they will not want to take the money. And that's the thing. And I'm not sure what would be the role. Your question, Chair.
Take the bait.
Okay. Yeah. Your question, Chair, about the influence of the department, you know, in influencing processes in the province, particularly through the HSD, this question of capacity and taking up of the because it's going to make the program suffer. Just thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Gumeni.
I would just like to go into the one that Mike has just emphasized on the person is because he has not reached the point where I wanted it. This understanding or
that's
because Jefferson, there are some people during the disaster, there were people who were compensated way back from 2003. Now, as we do not know how are these people related to each other, the municipality, the province, and the national, can they maybe explain to say, how far do they go with their money compared to the province and the municipality? Because every time you go home, there are people running behind your car. Not to mention, my compensation for that disaster for 2003, I didn't, some don't even have houses really. Okay, thank you, Chair. And then the other one, Chair, is about in page 8. The 3,014, 912 children. Why does it happen? The growth of the number of these children really is a worry to me. Because I think there is typically something wrong. There must be something typically wrong. Now, can the department maybe tell us if they do make a follow-up as to the increase of this number, the tremendous increase of this offense? It gives me a worry. It means after 10 years, there will be no children that have for parents, and there will be no parents that have for children, if it has got to increase in this case. Then the other one, Chairperson, we have seen the huge growth in the transfers to the NGOs, to the NPOs. Now, can the department maybe explain as to what are they doing to tighten up the management with this organization? And then the other one, Chairperson, is about... The register on offense and vulnerable children, Chairperson, is commendable, liable, though I've got a concern. How will the department ensure that services to these children are in fact an integrated package to those services? Thank you. But I have left one, Chairperson, but I can live with it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Right. We had somebody before Comrade Makan. Comrade Makan.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to comment on the issue of organization that are getting funded to the society aid organization. You will find out these organizations that have received funding that are working with government are the previous organization that can make good proposals and all that. I think it can be proper if as a committee can exactly get which are those organizations and to see exactly what are they doing in those communities and they are working with government. Also, there is this thing of re-registered of NPOs. What I want to understand, is there any training after these people are registered and also that they can know exactly what are expected of them, what are exactly they are doing in those communities? And you will find out that people are registered as NPOs. At the end of the day, they are not getting funding, either from provinces or wherever. You will find out that they are getting only from the private sector. What exactly can be done in order for them to do exactly what is expected of them so that they can get the funding for the things that they are doing? Other organizations in our community are very good at doing things, but they are not good at doing business yet. I think I'll appeal to the department to assist those organizations. Otherwise, most of us of the organization. Also, I think it would be proper for us to assist you in terms of oversight and monitoring. The province will just give us the breakdown of organizations that we are assisting, so that at the end of the day, we are also your eyes in terms of monitoring what they are doing. Because you find out that there are organizations that are continuously getting funds. That is one person that. That person is doing the same thing. It's a project. That person is employing people to do something for her. So that is when they still go and display this is a project for women. At that time, that project is herself. She is just doing external selling for herself.
All right,
Mr.
I think we need to capture your
interest. Thank you, Chairperson. My question is on ECD. Expansion of the ECD, is a priority, and rightly so. How is the department going to strengthen the following areas? One, capacity for speed of processing applications for registry. Aligning ECD provincial targets with ECD integrated plans and the extended public works program, social sector plan. Thirdly, capacity building at national and provincial spheres to oversee the rollout of this group, of the program. My second question is on the costing of the Children's Act, the costing of the Children's Act. It is a concern to all of us. Please provide provide an update very briefly on any new developments in this regard and comment on the latest development in terms of implementation. It's all very well to have this grant scheme, but the implementation which can change the quality of life of our people is important and create like some kind of change.
Right, and of course there, I mean, this 52 billion and 60,000 social workers that are needed to implement it, Aaron, as far as I'm concerned, those issues do not even arise. We have to focus on getting provinces to come up with clear plans of how they're going to gradually grow their capacity to provide not only children's services, but welfare services. And now that we've removed grants to SASA, I think there's going to be a number of areas where we're going to have a more focused kind of interaction, where we bring provinces here and other relevant people. The issue of the NGOs, for example, with Comrade Magasi, that Comrade Magasi raises. The NPO office in the department, we may want to have a special meeting with them, with provinces, because partly the whole issue of funding, and then the NDA in terms of their own role and developing their capacity. I think that let me get Okoshi the final bite, and then I'll give the department.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is in relation, in terms of asset management, Chairperson. They reported that capacity is 50%. Only this poses a serious challenge in our ability to maintain control and management. What are you doing to ensure that you increase capacity to ensure that proper control are in place? My last question, Chairperson, with regard to, we are aware that the department has been one of the leading departments in terms of poverty alleviation. Could you inform us what the department's input has been into the proposed poverty line as put forward by pressure? Thank you, Chairperson.
Can I say, in responding to the capacity issue and the vacancy issue, I think one of the things we're concerned about is, even if we're talking about 50% vacancy rate in the asset management line function, with how much of that 50% vacancy relates to absolutely critical functions, without which your entire asset management system is rendered completely dysfunctional. So I think a bit of a analysis to look at, you know, even if you've got a 20% reduction, isn't that 20% talking to very strategic, you know, functional or managerial kind of function, without which institutionally we're not on sound ground. So I think it needs to be more nuanced. All right.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yes, Honorable.
So on the issue, I had a question that I couldn't face because of your time, but it's just relating to the poverty reduction alleviation program, and it's specific to the NDA. So I wanted to raise it today, Chair, more strategically. to say that we've been having problems with that as the capacity of the NDA. And when I'm sure we will be more specific in having the same question when the NDA is with us in the coming week. But the issue we need to hear in terms of last year the department presented that together with the NDA that there would be a turnaround strategy. We do need some strategic comment from the department here today in relation to what with the NDA.
Well, except that you missed that part where the AG's office had an extensive impact on a lot of other issues that particular issue. But I'll nevertheless allow the department to be very different. Look, we have run out of time. I think that we must just get the DG's response and not have any follow-up response to the question, and basically also by way of rounding up.
Well, thanks, Captain. I was hoping that I would immediately prefer.
If you prefer that option, that's okay.
And Mr. Sakara was dealing with the one on control, and the PGT chapter was dealing with the one relationship to the human form and the strategy. I'm sure that all the notion
that very, very short comment.
Yes, honourable members, I think the impression that you have is correct. We are concerned as you are. We have been losing people in this area at a very high rate. I think it's because of the new supply chain management policy framework that has been implemented. People are in demand, so they are getting a lot of offers elsewhere. But in the meantime, in the department, because we're one of the departments that have been up to date, been able to comply with the minimum requirements set by Treasury. And every year there is an additional obligation that gets given to the department. What we have done now, we have reviewed the entire unit, which looks into the entire systems and processes and procedures around asset management and logistics. We are currently, in fact, we have evaluated our current system, and we found it has certain, the actual system, the asset management system, FastTrack that we're using. Now, we are also upgrading that system currently as we speak. We will be also what we call evaluating the jobs that are currently available there in that unit. Because what we have identified also is that some of the posts that we have are not adequately at the level at which we require the kind of skill that is required in terms of the new financial reforms that Treasury is coming up with. So we are looking for more qualified people now in that area. However, in terms of filling, we are filling those approved posts there. For instance, tomorrow we are interviewing Assistant Director Asset Management, whom we are hopeful that we will be able to appoint in terms of the time frame that the DG outlined, which is probably a month's time after the necessary notices have been given by that person. So it's an area we are really focusing our attention on in terms of the in fact, even the challenges that were picked up by the Auditor General, we can assure the committee that it is one of our priorities, Chair. I'm not sure whether there is any other issue around controls, but I think just briefly on the NGO issue, I think we do have some kind of monitoring mechanism when we transfer money to NGOs. First and foremost, we do some kind of groundwork in terms of the kind of NGO will be finding, what is the main objective, what are they doing, do some bit of due diligence. But we also find some kind of agreement with them. Amongst the requirements is to ensure that they give a certain report, and we do evaluate those reports. Depending, for instance, if it's HIV and AIDS program or any other program, they do provincial visits or site visits as well to check whether, in fact, if they said they are going to be doing some kind of communal farming around that area, if it is indeed taking place. I'm not sure whether the question that was raised about a specific funding that was given, and whether it was a national or provincial funding.
You see, that's part of the communication, is that a lot of the actual funding of NGOs seems to be provincially located. So, but we'll find a way around how do we exercise oversight in relation to, you know, areas that are essentially the function of the policy. Look, I think that we really run out of time. I'll not really ask the DDG to respond, but to make any final comments or remarks in just a minute on any points that she wants to put emphasis on without attempting to respond to all the questions. We'll find a way to take some of those issues forward.
Thank you. Very briefly with the question around the expansion of ECG. I'm sure you will be happy, honorable members, to hear that as one of our updates is for the next medium term expenditure framework is really addressing those, specifically those areas that you have asked questions on in terms of ensuring that we accelerate the registration of new sites, ensuring that we train the practitioners within ECG and so forth. And so the piece is addressing those areas. But also the around the question on disability policy, we are crossing the disability policy and the comprehensive policy that deals with various issues that relate to disability services as provided by the Department of Social Development. And we are acknowledging the fact that within residential facilities, we have people, for example, we have children that have disabilities that are within homes. And we are, and therefore the policy is beginning to say, how do you ensure that those children that are within homes are indeed kept to the extent that the norms and standards and they access services in the way that is acceptable in terms of addressing their issues. So it's not about the houses. I'm sorry to raise an expectation that you get a house that is dangerous. The EP policy, once more, the issue of victims is a departmental responsibility. And the departmental responsibilities acknowledges the fact that victims need to ensure that they access various services. And within that part, shelter is only but one of the services or aspects that need to be accessed by victims, but also the victim charter identifies various areas of services that the victims need to access. And I think it's again, it's a responsibility of all of us as government to begin to say, are we really implementing the victims charter to the extent that those victims do access various services that they need to access. And I think there's still a gap there in terms of government-wide providing various services to victims.
I think we can only go so far, time has run out, but I want to say that there's a number of areas that clearly we need further engagement. One of the issues that I think we need to look at is when we do our strategic planning early next year, we'll need to isolate out some of these issues, like the legislative and policy development and implementation program of the department. This is an overarching kind of issue. That talks to a number of some of these issues. I've had a debate with my previous DG when I was still in my other life as an official, whether it's adequate to develop these programs and come up with policies without being backed by any legislation. Because sometimes, because there's no legislation, some of these programs have become small experiments that run for a year or two, they die, almost nobody even pays attention to what happens to them. Issues of equal access, you know, the right issues relating to those things. And as Parliament, obviously, will guard jealously
our own constitutional mandate of making laws, and we would be not so impressed with the other side, you know, moving with policy and so on without some of the things coming this side through legislation, so that we are able to regulate some of these activities through legislation. But I'll not take it any further than that for now. I am going to adjourn the meeting with some snack, I think, outside. Unfortunately, we are not going to have a Rolls-Royce lunch today because of venue problems with the restaurants that are on the street. Thank you very much for all the contributions, especially to the AGIS office for the time you've taken to come here. I do not know whether you want to have another session with us, the hour session next week, or you feel it's been adequate, you've covered the issues you wanted to cover in relation to CASA and NDN next week, Wednesday. Otherwise, we can take you by way of responding to some of the issues after they have presented and responded to some of the issues you raised. We'll try and meet still at 9 o'clock if we could try that, but then proceed straight with the proceedings with Sarah and Sarah so that we have more time. Alright? Thank you. The meeting is over.
Yeah.